movement, rebuilding of life in Los Angeles, and there were lots of meetings at their house. And between his trips and travels, I got to meet him there when he was in town, and we would get to talk. And I think I learned to love them both so much. They were both political friends, but they also became almost family friends. And I feel like I'm stealing from your family in some ways to say that, Frank, I felt also Frank as a member of my family, but I did, so I'm gonna take it. That's how I felt. And I know there's a lot of anecdotes that everybody has, but I know I'm going to share one quickly because I know it's one of Donna's favorites. And that is that when we were expecting, my husband and I were expecting our first son, Dan and I, and Donna and Frank really kindly offered to give us a baby shower. And we got there that day, and Donna took me aside to say that that morning, Frank had said to her, "Now, I know Jan's mother is coming. Are there any other adults?" And she pointed out, I will share with you that I was 37. And she pointed out that there were about 20 of us coming. But I take that with affection because I feel like it really showed that Frank accepted me as a peer at the left, but he also accepted me as somebody from the next generation and treated me that way appropriately. A decade later, I was started working in the early 90s as a housing advocate. And I was working with a lot of nonprofit organizations that are really trying to create a new model of housing. We're trying to create almost a new movement around the how to build housing for poor people, how to create community. On a national scale, this effort included rejecting an image of public housing that had become prevalent in this country, an image that said that public housing was nothing but ugly blocks that produced and perpetuated crime, blight, and poverty. Many of the people in this movement didn't realize there was, in fact, a different history of public housing, a history that was much more positive, a history that did not have to be rejected, a history that had to be embraced. And part of that history, and one of the heroes of that history, was Frank Wilkinson. In the late 40s and 50s, Frank worked in public affairs of the Los Angeles Housing Authority. And this was a local housing authority that had as its mission to rid Los Angeles of all slum housing. It was committed to integrated housing, and Frank was committed with it. He believed in the possibility that solving the city's post-war housing crisis could contribute to integrating the city, it could contribute to making it a better place, You all know the major story by now of Chavez Ravine. It was one of Frank's biggest projects. The idea was to build integrated housing in what was Chavez Ravine. It was to be designed by LA's foremost modern architect, Richard Neutra. You've either read the history, you've seen the culture class play, you've heard the CD, or you've seen the photograph books. But basically, the Housing Authority planned to take it. This was a neighborhood that had no services, no streets, no utilities, but it had a community. The plan was to take it and to provide them safe, decent, architecturally beautiful housing that would allow their community to come back and live decent, solid lives in the community that they had created. The project got as far as the relocation. Many of the residents lived willingly because they believed what Frank told them about their ability to come back into this new housing. Because Frank made that promise because he knew that that promise could, and in his way, if he had his way, would be kept. But history intervened, as we know. The city went back on its promise. The housing wasn't built. Frank's effort to forge a different reality brought him into the long lens of the McCarthy, FBI, the House on American Activities. The housing was abandoned and Frank went to jail. When he came out, he went on to the civil liberties work that defined the rest of his life. Chavez Ravine went to the Dodgers, and for those of us in housing, history for a while was lost. That housing crisis didn't end. Today, Los Angeles has one of the worst housing crises in the country. More than one in six families lives in apartments that are too small for them. We have slum housing is a growth industry. But we are doing things. We have activism, we have advocates, we have people who believe in it. We formed the Housing Trust Fund, for which that lovely dinner acknowledged. We are on our way to getting more housing for it. We are getting more funding for it.
The fight is long from over. Sometimes it seems as hard today as it was during Frank's time. But today, as we celebrate so much of his civil liberties, more than ever in the time of the Patriot Act and condone torture and spying, those of us who work in housing know that we don't walk alone. We walk in Frank's shoes. We've gotten our history by having his history as part of us. And we know that Frank was one of the world's, this country's, first housers, a term that doesn't get used very often, unfortunately doesn't mean much to people, but to us it means somebody who dedicates their time and energy so that everybody has a safe, affordable, decent place to live. We have that thanks to our history. Thank you so much, Frank's family, for sharing him with us, and thank you all very much. And I just want to say, when I took my job, Donna, I was late because I had to go get this picture. Donna gave me this picture, as she told me to come over and talk to Frank about his history. This is a picture of a Lisa Village housing project taken when Frank was assistant to the executive director of the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles. It was taken in 1950, and you can't see it, but this is children of every race playing together in the City of Los Angeles in public housing. What the future can be. Thank you.
Frank was fortunate enough to have lived long enough to have been part of this kind of whole movement about the telling and the retelling and kind of the bringing to light the history of Chavez Ravine. So the play, books, there's actually a fairly recent book, a wonderful book by Don Parson about the history of public housing to make a better world in LA. I think the copy's at the back. You should read that book. So we had a lot of attention in various media, but it was left to our next speaker to create a magnificent musical tribute to the people of Chavez Ravine. I think Frank may have been the only person that I knew at the time who didn't know who Ry Cooder was. But I think Frank had seen the Buena Vista Social Club at Pratt's, didn't make the connection, but I think if he was paying attention, then he realized that this man has great respect for his elders. So they did make a connection, and that was a benefit to all of us. So our next speaker is Ry Cooder.
Real honor to be here. I'll tell you how it was just exactly. It was about a year and a half ago, and I was working really hard to try to figure out how in the world you could write songs, 4-minute songs, about these Chavez Ravine events and the people. And I was looking at some older Chicano musicians, Lalo Guerrero, people of this kind, for their memories and their musical ability. But then there was this whole other side to the story, the political side, the housing side, and I was reading Dana Cuff's wonderful book about the politics and the architecture. And I came across this chapter, which is what I was looking for, is Frank Wilkinson's story. I had a vague idea who he was in all of this kind of thing. But I got down to the paragraph where it says the object of a plot against his life by the FBI. And I said, all right, there we go. Now that'll make a good song. That's what we need in a song. You need something that danger or some kind of event that you can turn the lyrics around, because this is history. It's very complicated. You know, Frank's life and his oral history. Just imagine all the stories we're going to hear today. It's all very complex. I got a 4-minute song here. So I can really use this assassination idea. So I called up Dana Cuff. I said, where is Frank Wilkinson? And she says, oh, just call him. Here's his phone number. It's very easy. So I called on the phone right that day, you know, from the cell phone in the car and driving along. And Donna answered, and I said, "This is Wright Cruger calling. And I'd like to come and talk to Frank sometime. I'm trying to make music and write songs, and he's a character that I want to include if I can." And so she said, "Well, let me ask him. Frank, it's Wright Cruger on the phone. You know the guy from the Cuban thing?" So he said something, I didn't hear what he said. And she said, "Yeah, he says that's fine, come right over." I said, "Well, like when? Today, tomorrow, next week?" "No," he said, "give him 20 minutes. So I went, you know, went off the freeway, got back on the freeway, and went around to the little neighborhood where they live. It's very nice. And just went in and sat down. And there where Donna was, and the dogs, and Frank, and pictures. And I said, "All right, let's see what we can do." And I'm thinking to myself, if he can sing, can I just write the lyrics for him? He can sing. It would be so great if this man could sing. "My name is Frank Wilkinson. The truth to you, I'll tell," that kind of thing. Like an old union ballad. But I saw that he was having some trouble hearing, and that it would be hard for him if I had a, let's say there's two verses or three verses. This is going to take some doing, so maybe it's a lot of work. So I'm just going to listen to him talk and try to get the speech rhythm and the mode of expression that's his, you know. And when he got to the part about, "I outlived all the bastards in me." All right. So that was the conclusion of it. And then I sampled Jack Webb, and I sampled that guy Shorter, that dreadful senator. "That's my voice of Frank Wilkinson, a known communist agent," and all this kind of stuff. And then we sandwiched it all together with me trying to channel Frank's voice and his thinking and trying to be him, which is a tricky thing because maybe the family doesn't like this, or maybe it's going to offend somebody, you know. This is the great Frank Wilkinson here, and I'm putting words in his mouth. They were mostly his speaking. But then I got to the end where I thought, I'm going to mention this because they took me to, as a friend, into the house and were very kind and gave me all this material to watch. And so I stole a line out of The Naughty Lady of Shady Lane, and in which the lyric goes, "In the end, fate has been good to me. If you're in the neighborhood stranger, you're welcome to drop in and see." And that's how they were with me. They were very welcoming, and it was great. It was my favorite part of the whole record. So, of course, we appreciate it very much. I hope the family's not offended. I hope they like the song. Thank you.
We're going to get two wonderful people for the price of one. Mayor Villaraigosa is, I think, still in Washington. He left Donna a message last night, a very warm message. But we have both Jackie Goldberg and Karen Bass here to speak for the city of Los Angeles.
Wraps you up, and he was just beaming, and it just made all of, he got a standing ovation.
And most of the people in the audience didn't know him, but they felt like they did after the play, and it was because it was culture clash at its best, you know, when they're outrageous and yet they're telling us the history of our own city. And Frank was a man who inspired people, you know, he really did. He inspired people because he was courageous. You know, and courage is inspiring, it is, because all of us, you know, we're trained by this society to think about how this might hurt me somehow if I do this, or to hold back a little, or to worry if it's going to have consequences for me or my family or my career or my something. And we tend to, it's carefully taught. It's taught in school, it's taught everywhere we go, to be worried that they're going to come get you somehow. Of course, these guys in Washington, they really might come get us. But Frank lived in a time when they did come and get you, and he did it anyway. And you know, I think that's a message for our time. Because those guys really do want to take us back to then and even worse. I can't help but every day I hear more of their atrocities and think, you know, this could be the 30s in Germany. And I don't miss that. I used to tell people when they'd say stuff like that to me, oh, you know, don't do that. That gilds the lily. That's the wrong message. I don't say that anymore. Now I say we must be organizing to defend each other and to fight back and to know that if they come for any of us, all of us are going to say, take me. More Donna. There are other kids now. We're not the kids anymore. But I think we should have a Frank Wilkinson Brigade. No meetings. No Robert's Rules of Orders. No officers. Just a large email mailing list in which we decide to do outrageous actions, in which we just appear, do them, and go home. Think about it. I'll be talking to all of you. Make sure that I have your email mailing list. I'm done in Sacramento at the end of this year. And thank God Karen Bass will be there. Those things that we all care about. But I want to just come and say to all of you who are the family and the friends and the admirers of Frank Wilkinson, we are all better because he lived, because he touched our lives, because he showed us a model of courage and integrity, and we just have to keep remembering that it's our goal to live up to those ideals and to pass it on to the next generation. So I was very proud to have the opportunity to make all my right-wing Republican colleagues listen to me eulogize Frank on the floor of the assembly. I'll get the family a copy of the tape, and they're all doing this, you know. But I didn't care. I went on and on. It's important for us to honor and to respect his memory and his life, but it's important for us to pick up that torch and to pass it on. And so on behalf of the city of Los Angeles, Karen and I are going to present this, but I'm going to let her speak first before we call the family in.
Well, people ask me how I managed to make it in Sacramento, and I think that you can see how I do. It's I'm really going to miss Jackie when she leaves next year. But, you know, I describe myself as an activist whose current occupation is an elected official. What's important is that I'll always be an activist. That's and what I want to do is thank and honor Frank, because although I knew Donna and John much better than I knew Frank, I was very honored to know Frank and know of him and know of his life and know of his courage and know of the repression that he went through in those years, because I represent the generation that came after that. But you know, it's because he was able to stand strong, because he was clear about who he was, what his values were, what he stood for, what he was fighting for, that he could withstand that repression. And I remember on numerous occasions hearing him speak and hearing him joke about the fact that the CIA traveled all over the country with him. Whether he had the CIA accompanying him or the FBI, he knew he never traveled alone. They were always there. And that was very important to me because, like many of you know, I mean, we went through our dark period here too, where we had to deal with the PDID, the LAPD Red Squad, and we had to go through a layer of repression, nothing like the prior generation, but we still went through our battles. But it was because of examples of people like Frank that I knew that that time would pass, that I knew that I could stand strong. And so long as I was clear about who I was and what I was fighting for, they weren't going to be able to bring me down. And so as I got older, and now I'm in the very honorable position of having to raise and train another generation of activists, you know, and we told them about the repression that we went through in the 70s, and they had a hard time believing it, and then on one day, all of a sudden, they understood. When 9/11 came along, and we got the Patriot Act, and we had to go back in history, and then they understood that they certainly face the repression that the previous generations have gone through. And so I feel that it's my honor and my responsibility to carry on his legacy, for people to understand who Frank was, what he fought for, how he was able to withstand, and how he never steered from his values or what he stood for and what he was fighting for. And I feel very honored to be able to pass that history on, and just to let him know how much we honored and respect and loved him and his work. Thank you very much.
I guess most of you are certainly our California people know that we were just hearing from two state assembly people, Jackie and Karen. And I also was reminded that Jackie was really part of this whole process 10 years ago when the city of LA apologized, I believe, to Frank and gave him a commendation for for his service to the people of Los Angeles. So. Frank's name is synonymous with civil liberties. Our next speaker is equally so. I used to think that Frank perhaps worked for this woman because he was always at the ACLU photocopying. He had photocopying privileges. She can tell you the real story. This is the executive director, the longtime executive director of the ACLU of Southern California, Ramona Ripston.
I know that many of us in this beautiful sanctuary are devoted to the Bill of Rights and in securing its blessings of liberty, equality, and justice for all. We lobby to keep it strong. We fight in the courts to prevent it from being weakened. But how many of us are willing to sacrifice our lives, our safety, our comfort, our careers, and our reputation to protect it? Not many, but Frank was. When Frank was subpoenaed and questioned by the House Un-American Activities Committee, He refused to answer questions about his protected beliefs, about organizations he belonged to, about activities protected by the First Amendment, telling the committee that it had no right to investigate what it could not regulate. For the courageous act of being faithful to the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, Frank was imprisoned for 9 months. His appeal to the United States Supreme Court was lost, 5-4. But he didn't back down. When he was released, Frank backed by tirelessly working to dismantle the House Un-American Activities Committee. Eventually, he won that fight, though the courts refused to admit wrongdoing in Frank's prosecution and imprisonment. Frank is rightly beloved for championing the First Amendment, for his devotion to freedom of speech and conscience. But his devotion to the principles of the 14th Amendment, to the simple proposition that we are all equal and deserve equal treatment, was equally intense. After all, Frank's troubles began when he pushed for racially integrated housing to alleviate some of the harshness of poverty and break down some of the barriers that segregation and prejudice had built up, keeping us from being together and recognizing our mutual humanity. That effort earned him the wrath of the small-minded, the fearful, and the petty, who then sought to stop him. But they never stopped him. Later, when Frank learned that the FBI tried to cancel his speeches and disrupt them with saboteurs, spied on him, and infiltrated the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, Frank fought back, suing the FBI. Along with the then ACLU legal director Paul Hoffman and volunteer attorney and board member Doug Morrell, Frank fought in the courts for close to a decade for justice. Eventually, the FBI was forced to give up all the documents, 132 pages, they had amassed and pay damages. Characteristically, Frank didn't see this as a victory for only himself. He saw that the vindication of his right demonstrated the need for legislation to stop the government from violating the First Amendment by spying on Americans, and the need for we the people to be vigilant in opposing such activities and holding the government accountable. I knew Frank from the mid-70s on, and I'd like to tell you just a bit about the man I knew and worked with, both in the ACLU and the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, and later the First Amendment Foundation, of which I am a board member. Frank was a gentle giant who couldn't be stopped. He fought against the government, it's true, but he also fought against pain and aging, carrying on speaking and traveling to tell his story so that others could learn from it. He fought against riches. He fought against the government. I guess the only fight that he didn't, the only thing that he didn't fight against was publicity. He really loved that. Well into his 80s, he would come to the ACLU office to copy documents. He stood at that copying machine for hours. A younger, stronger person would have rebelled. When he could no longer carry the documents he had copied, he bought a luggage carrier to hold them. And around the country he went, to colleges, to universities, to ACLU affiliates, wherever he could find them, traveling on a senior pass to save money. He talked to young audiences who were spellbound by his life story. No matter how much pain he was in, no matter how stooped he became, he would not give up. And those young people loved him. To them, he was a hero. Frank was honored by the ACLU of Southern California. He received the very first Easton Monroe Courageous Advocating Award, an award the ACLU gives each year without any thought to money to a person whose life has been dedicated to courage. A few years later, the entire ACLU honored Frank, giving him its Medal of Freedom. Well, for a while, it seemed the example of people like Frank had led to a new national consensus that we wanted to prevent a repeat of the excesses of the McCarthys and the Hoopers and the Nixons. We had a heightened sensitivity toward the importance of free speech and privacy. We want limitations on the government's capacity for domestic spying. We seemed to think, learned our lesson. But today, those protections are eroding. We hear the White House telling Americans that they must be careful what they say. We have a misnamed Patriot Act, weakening our constitutional protections. We read of warrantless government wiretaps and wonder if we have gone back in time. One commentator suggested that seeing all this, Frank may have actually died of a broken heart. But I don't think our current crisis broke Frank any more than government harassment or unjust prosecution or prison did. I think Frank would tell us that we have to work even harder, stand up even taller, and rise to the challenge just as he did. Cynics might say Frank's life proves that no good deed goes unpunished. After all, because of his principles, he suffered more than most of us ever will suffer. Death threats, job loss, blacklisting, imprisonment. Nevertheless, I think that Frank belonged, that no good deed should go undone, so he did as many good deeds as he could do. The FBI spied on him because they thought he was a dangerous American. Dangerous to indifference, dangerous to cruelty, dangerous to injustice. We should all, every one of us, strive to be so dangerous. Strive to do as much good as Frank did. Strive to be so strong in our compassion. Strive to have the courage to live our convictions, to never give up on the dream of making this a more just and better world. There is just one final dream of Frank's that I want to talk about today. One vision left unrealized. One major goal left unaccomplished in his inspiring but too short life. Frank had wanted to grab a ladder, climb up to the front of the FBI headquarters, and in an act of both political defiance and public works improvement, chisel J. Edgar Hoover's name off the front of the FBI. Forward with this memory in our mind, we will never forget Frank Lucas.